It's Thursday, December 28th in Asia, and Wednesday the 27th here in Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. Coming up, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry lays out several U.S. principles for what an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal should look like. It triggers an angry response from Israel's prime minister and a conditional pledge to resume peace talks from the Palestinian president. We'll have reaction from two U.S.-based groups that support and oppose the Israeli government's peace policies. And we'll also take a look back at the career of British pop star George Michael, who died this past week at the age of 53. It's all ahead on International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry unveiled broad guidelines on Wednesday for an eventual peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians, warning that a two-state solution to the conflict is in serious jeopardy. No major new proposals were included in the six parameters outlined in Kerry's speech. Rather, the address was aimed at preserving the generally agreed-upon framework of a two-state solution that has been embraced by the last several U.S. administrations. Kerry said there was no viable alternative to the two-state solution.
Now, we all know that a speech alone won't produce peace. But based on over 30 years of experience and the lessons from the past 4 years, I have suggested, I believe, and President Obama has signed on to and believes in, a path that the parties could take. Realistic steps on the ground now, consistent with the parties' own prior commitments, that will begin the process of separating into two states, a political horizon to work towards, to create the conditions for a successful final status talk, and a basis for negotiations that the parties could accept to demonstrate that they are serious about making peace.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in a statement after Kerry's speech that for over an hour, Kerry obsessively dealt with settlements and barely touched upon the root of the conflict, which he said was Palestinian opposition to a Jewish state in any boundaries.
The persistent Palestinian refusal to recognize a Jewish state remains the core of the conflict, and its removal is the key to peace. Palestinian rejection of Israel and support for terror are what the nations of the world should focus on if they truly want to advance peace. And I can only express my regret and say that it's a shame that Secretary Kerry does not see this simple truth.
Chief Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat said President Mahmoud Abbas remains committed to pursuing peace with Israel, but only under certain conditions. And he also reiterated this message from Mahmoud Abbas.
The minute the Israeli government agrees to cease all settlement activities, including in East Jerusalem, and agrees to implement, on the basis of reciprocity, agreement signed, that the Palestinian leadership stands ready to resume permanent status negotiations on the basis of international law, relevant international legality resolutions, including the recent Security Council Resolution 2334-2016.
Ori Neer is a member of Americans for Peace Now, which is a U.S.-based group that is critical of Israeli policies toward the Palestinians. I spoke to Ori Neer earlier on the phone, and I asked him why Israeli settlement activity is so problematic for pursuing peace.
You know, Americans for Peace Now is a sister organization of Peace Now in Israel. It's Israel's largest peace movement. And we and our friends in Israel have been opposing settlements since the inception of the occupation in 1967, since they started building settlements there, because we believe that they're bad for Israel. We make a clear distinction between Israel, which we support, obviously, and the settlements in the West Bank, which we think are bad for Israel. We think that they are, in the long run, going to deny Israel's nature, Israel's character as a Jewish state and as a democracy. Settlements are a security liability. They're siphoning funds from Israel's budget. They are a political liability, obviously, and they're an obstacle to peace. So we totally agree, 100% agree with Secretary Kerry's criticism of the settlements, and we've acted now for many, many years to try to stop settlement activity in the West Bank.
Well, in terms of that activity, What evidence can you provide to back up John Kerry's claim that the settlements will prevent the creation of a contiguous Palestinian state?
There are about 120 settlements in the West Bank, and in addition to that, about 100 illegal outposts. So those are small settlements that were created without government approval in the West Bank. So those communities, those settlements, are spread out throughout the West Bank. In order to create a Palestinian state, you have to put an end to that kind of Swiss cheese nature of the West Bank and create contiguity. At the moment, it's impossible. In order to create some contiguity in the western part, in the eastern part of the West Bank, the one that's closer to Jordan, close to the Jordan River, you will have to remove a massive amount of Israeli settlements that are there. That's the bad news. The good news is that the minority of the settler population lives in those settlements. So you won't have to remove that many settlers in order to create that contiguity. The problem is that the more you thicken those settlements, the more difficult it becomes politically and otherwise to remove those settlements in order to create contiguity. And that's really what it's all about.
Well, as you know, Israel has removed settlements in the past, both as part of agreements with its neighbors and unilaterally. So why don't you think Israel could do so in future, as part of a deal while still building in those places before the deal is reached?
It could, and we think it should, and at the moment we think it's still possible, but it becomes less and less possible. The more settlers move into the West Bank, the more there is infrastructure for settlements and for the settlers in the West Bank, the more difficult it would be for a future prime minister who decides to sign a peace agreement with the Palestinians to do that, to move those settlers out of there.
And that was Ori Ner of the group Americans for Peace Now. For a different perspective, I also spoke on the phone to Omri Seren. He's press director for the Israel Project, a Washington-based group that is supportive of the Israeli government's positions toward the Palestinians. I asked Seren for his reaction to Kerry's argument that the only alternative to the current two-state framework is one state for Arabs and Jews.
You know, that was a very strange part of Kerry's speech, because the principles that Kerry laid out are actually 10-year, 15-year, 20-year-old principles, with a couple of exceptions. But the overarching framework that he laid out is actually solutions that have been kicking around for decades. And that highlighted the strangeness of the speech, because the beginning of the speech was all about how long-standing efforts and principles have failed, and then the end of the speech was Kerry saying that we need to double down on all of those principles. And the rhetoric of the two-state solution is more of that. Nobody serious says that there shouldn't be some kind of settlement between the Israelis and the Palestinians that ends up with some kind of Palestinian state. The debate has always been, how do you get there and what kind of Palestinian state? So in essence, this was one of many places where Kerry attacked a straw argument by saying that, that nobody is, that it's his solution or no other solution.
And what do Israelis think of that? I mean, do Israelis really believe that a one-state solution is inevitable? Is there progress on the two-state track?
Support for a peace deal and support for efforts of exactly the kind that have been going on for decades is supported by the majority of Israelis and is the official policy of the Israeli government. The idea that, it was another part of Kerry's speech that was frankly bizarre and seemingly empty. Israelis don't need to be lectured on the need for peace. They know about the need for peace. They live it every day.
Well, there was no admission of faults from Kerry during his speech about any mistakes that he and the Obama administration might have made that led to the situation we're in now, in which there has not been progress on the peace track. Where do you think that he and Obama may have slipped up in this effort?
No, that's exactly the right question. It's another strange part of Kerry's speech. You know, Kerry's speech said that the Israelis and the Palestinians are farther away from peace than they've ever been. Well, it's the president and Secretary Kerry who've been innovating new policies for the last 8 years to try to bring them to the table that have actually been disastrous and predictably disastrous policies. You know, when the president and when the president called for a settlement freeze, and the Israelis then did a 10-month settlement freeze, it hardened the Palestinian positions. Palestinian leaders themselves later said that the administration, by endorsing policies that previous administrations had never endorsed, the rhetoric of Palestinian leaders was, Obama asked us to climb a tree with him, and then he left us, and then he climbed down and left us there. And that's actually true. The president and Kerry, by embracing policies that were widely predicted to be counterproductive, widely predicted, new forms of pressure on the Israelis, publicly bashing the Israelis, publicly calling out the Israelis. They were told, don't do this. You're going to harden Palestinian positions and make it more difficult for the Israelis to make concessions. And that's exactly what happened.
And that was Omri Sarin of the Israel Project. Here are some of the top stories right now on VOAnews.com. Donald Trump accuses Barack Obama of setting inflammatory roadblocks to the U.S. political transition. The U.S. calls a Pakistani student group a wing of a banned militant organization. Former Uruguayan dictator Alvarez dies at the age of 91. And Charleston shooter will not submit evidence at the penalty phase of his trial. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on voanews.com. This is International Edition. Well, even before Donald Trump is inaugurated as president on January 20th, the U.S. Senate will begin considering his nominees for top administration posts. VOA's Michael Bowman reports that Democrats are expressing serious concerns about Trump's cabinet picks, but may not be able to block them on their own.
Donald Trump is making bold predictions about his White House team.
I think it's going to be one of the great cabinets ever, ever, ever.
In choosing his presidential inner circle, Donald Trump drew from corporate boardrooms, the military, and the ranks of conservative pro-business public servants. Perhaps no Trump nominee has gotten more attention than petroleum executive Rex Tillerson, tapped to be his Secretary of State.
I'm a businessman.
As CEO of ExxonMobil, Tillerson is no stranger to the halls of power around the world, something he spoke about at a business forum earlier this year.
My relationship with Vladimir Putin, which dates back almost 15 years now, he understands that I'm a businessman. And I've invested a lot of money, our company has invested a lot of money in Russia.
We're going to ask a lot of questions, and we'll see what sorts of answers Mr. Tillerson has.
Democrat Chris Coons serves on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that will consider Tillerson's nomination.
There are both Republicans and Democrats asking questions about Mr. Tillerson's potential conflicts of interest, about his long and close relationship with Vladimir Putin in Russia, and about his ability to balance the demands of being a diplomat and fighting for America's interests with his long experience leading an oil and gas company.
Analyst John Hudak of the Brookings Institution is predicting clashes on Capitol Hill.
The confirmation hearings, at least some of them, will be very contentious. This is going to be, in some ways, Trump's first test of congressional relations.
Most Senate Republicans, including Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, are rallying around Trump's picks.
I've been very impressed with the nomination so far of the nominees that we're already aware of. I think I'm optimistic that they'll all be confirmed.
Republicans have a slight Senate majority, and if they remain united, they can assure Trump's cabinet selections are confirmed, according to Hudak.
These senators also realize they're going to have to work with this president over the coming years. And one of the easiest ways to sully the relationship between you and the president of your party is to really run his nominees through the ringer.
Democrats, meanwhile, will use confirmation hearings to illuminate and probe questions surrounding the nominees, hoping to sway public opinion and a few Republicans. The Constitution tasks senators with providing advice and consent on nominees, a duty Democrats like Senator Coons say they take seriously.
One of the signature features of American democracy is the separation of powers between the executive branch and the legislative branch.
But Democrats are limited by their minority status, according to Hudak.
There is not much that Democrats in the Senate can do without having two or three Republicans join with them.
For now, Trump is talking up his nominees, describing Tillerson as, quote, a fierce advocate for America's interests around the world. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study published in the medical journal Molecular Psychiatry suggests that overindulging on a lot of high-fat foods as a youngster could harm a person's cognitive functions as an adult. It's no secret that children and teens love to eat junk food. Eating high-fat foods over a long period of time can lead not only to problems such as obesity and possibly damage young and still developing brains, but new research is showing that eating a lot of fatty foods during adolescence may impact the brain in adulthood. The findings were made after researchers compared the brains of young and adult mice who were fed either high-fat or normal diets. The first signs of impaired cognitive functions of young mice who ate a high-fat diet started to show after only 4 weeks and before they even started to show a weight gain. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin, and it's time for a look at social media. David Byrd is with me in the studio, and David, I understand you've been looking at how Twitter users have been summing up their thoughts of 2016. What's the hashtag?
Well, the hashtag is hashtag 2016 in 4 words. And so the parameters are basically find 4 words to describe the previous year. Now, obviously, the election here in the United States played pretty high in politics. Tanner Kerr at T.S. Kerr said in his 2016 in 4 words, can't wait for Trump. Mahyar Tusi said Hillary didn't get arrested. Aisha A. said Trump not my president. Jeremy Little, who is at Jeremy Little, said thank you at Barack Obama. Errol Frick at Wayfarer92 said President Obama, you're fired. Hermosa at Nina Cloud said America elected a Cheeto. The overall feeling towards the year was one of being glad it's over. Jedi at Indigo_Buddha said 2017 will be better. Tiff at Tiff Aha said, can you leave now? Liliana Jimenez said 2016 in 4 words was, did this really happen?
I'm sensing a theme here.
Yeah. Ian Carroll at Ian Carroll, Ian D. Carroll, D-E-E Carroll said, please make it stop. Marcella at Hobbits of Shire said, catastrophic, sick, sad, and disgusting.
There wasn't anyone who had anything good to say about
Not really. Well,
there?
You know, it was a pretty tragic year. Yesterday we talked about losing Carrie Fisher. Brutally
right.
Honest K2SO said, rest in peace, princess. Sav at Savine Snape said, death needs new specs. And Chris Margaritis said, Betty White must survive. Now, a couple from the world of sports.
Okay.
Coach Corey's ego said Kessel Stanley Cup champion, referring to the Pittsburgh Penguins.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chicago Cubs had a very nice 4 words. They said, got this shiny trophy for winning the World Series. So
that's
2016
great.
in four words. My 4 words were, are you kidding me?
Thanks so much, David, for that roundup. If you want to follow David on Twitter, his handle is at David_DBird. Well, the world of pop music lost another star this past weekend, George Michael. My colleague Sarah Williams spoke with VOA Border Crossings host Larry London about Michael's long and successful career.
Christmas Day, of all days, to unfortunately lose George Michael at the age of 53, apparently from heart failure, although there is an investigation undergoing right now because there was perhaps some medication involved. George was very, very private, very, very secretive about his life. Not too many people knew a whole lot about his life. His partner, Fadi Fawaz, is the person who discovered him at home. They were supposed to go to lunch that day, and he was found unresponsive. Apparently, he suffered this heart failure the night before. When the medical team showed up at the house, there was, you know, it was already a lost cause. He was already gone. And so, it is a tremendous loss. George Michael, who sold over 100 million records throughout his career. The last album he put out, the last actual studio album, was 2004, and an album called Patience, although 10 years later he did release a collection of live songs called Symphonica was the album. He was on tour that year in 2014 when he came down with pneumonia and canceled the tour and faced death at that time. It was pretty close. In fact, they said that when he was in the hospital in Europe that they even had to perform a tracheotomy on him. And he never fully recovered. He was very, very quiet, very generous, which is things that are coming out now. All the money he donated to various charities and people in need.
I've been reading about that. He was involved with a number of organizations.
And a lot of people didn't know that. He was, a very humble man. He wasn't looking for the attention. He did things on a very quiet level. He didn't, you know, try to attract attention to himself. So it is a sad loss in what has been a very, very difficult year in the world of music. Leon Russell, Leonard Cohen, Glenn Frey, David Bowie, Prince. You know, it's just been a very, very difficult year of loss in the world of music.
Certainly has been. Thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. 'Cause I gotta have faith.
And that's George Michael's Faith leading us out for this edition of International Edition. My thanks to director Tracy Carter and engineer Nelson Lopes. If I had to summarize my 2016 in four words, I might say, grateful for the opportunities. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. You can follow me on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. We'll see you next time.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Ross Sea is a vast and remote area of water and ice in the Southern Ocean off the frigid coast of Antarctica. It is also home to an unusually diverse and rich ecosystem, unique in its climate and geography, and one of the last remaining areas on Earth that remains unspoiled by human activity. It is home to a wide variety of deep water species, and unlike nearly every other sea or ocean on our planet, its top predators, whales, seals, penguins, and seabirds, are still abundant. Precisely because life is still abundant in the Ross Sea, it is in danger of exploitation by humans, particularly by commercial interests, and at risk due to the impacts of climate change. That is why 24 states, including the United States, China, and Russia, as well as the European Union, created the Ross Sea Marine Protected Area, or MPA, at 1.55 million square kilometers, the world's largest ocean sanctuary. The Ross Sea MPA is designed to be a natural laboratory for valuable scientific research to increase our understanding of the impact of climate change and fishing on the ocean and its resources, said Secretary of State John Kerry in a written statement. This means that as of December 2017, when the agreement enters into force, the Ross Sea will be protected from nearly all human activity. 72% of these waters will be off-limits to commercial fishing, while in a few areas, some fish and krill may be harvested for scientific research. Other human activities will be strictly limited. The creation of the Ross Sea Marine Protected Area is an extraordinary step forward for marine protection, said Secretary of State Kerry, and it did not happen by accident. The creation of the Ross Sea MPA happened thanks to many years of persistent scientific and policy review, intense negotiations, and principled diplomacy. It happened because our nations understood the responsibility we share to protect this unique place for future generations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.